This is going to be the second in a series of summaries and the first in a series that will address our study of the hearsay rule with Professor Carol Buckner. This summary covers the basic definition of hearsay. Also, it covers non-hearsay uses. Next, it addresses implied assertions. And finally, this summary will cover the confrontation clause. First, the basic definition. As we have learned, hearsay is a statement made out of court, offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Now, by out of court, we mean a statement other than one made by the declarant while testifying at the trial or hearing. By using the terms offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, we are referring to the matter asserted by the declarant in the out-of-court statement, not the matter asserted more generally by the party that is offering the evidence in the case. So that is the basic definition. Now, generally, we refer to the witness as the person testifying and the declarant as the person who made the statement. Of course, sometimes this will be the same person where a witness is testifying about his or her own prior statement. We learned there are several dangers with hearsay. One of the key concerns being that the declarant, who is typically out of court, is not subject to being cross-examined regarding the statement. Also, we cannot evaluate the declarant's memory or demeanor. Now, let's turn to review the non-hearsay uses of out-of-court statements. We saw several examples of statements that were not considered hearsay because they were not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. One of the classic non-hearsay uses is to show confusion, for example, in a trademark infringement case. We saw this when the children said, "It's Barney." That statement was not being offered to prove that it actually was Barney. Instead, it was being offered to prove confusion. That is a non-hearsay use of the statement. Another category of non-hearsay uses involves statements that are offered to show knowledge, notice, or effect on a listener. In such situations, the court will generally give a limiting instruction that the evidence is not being offered for the truth of the matter. Another very important category of statements that are non-hearsay are those involving verbal acts. These are also often referred to as involving words of operative conduct or performative utterances. A couple examples of this are the fraudulent statement in a fraud case, statements evidencing an agreement, or perhaps the cancellation of an agreement, and statements that are allegedly defamatory. None of these are offered for the truth of the matter asserted. For example, the defamatory statements are offered to show falsity. The next category of potential hearsay statements involves implied assertions. The question here is whether a statement is actually made. An implied assertion might be made through words or through nonverbal conduct. If an implied assertion is made through words, it could be written or verbal. Now, at common law, all implied assertions were treated as hearsay, but this is no longer true under the Federal Rules of Evidence or the California Evidence Code. We did see that there is a minority view on this point, as we noted in the Dullard case in our materials, so that some jurisdictions would still treat these types of assertions as hearsay. Notice that, as I said, implied assertions can arise from verbal expressions or written conduct, and they can also arise from nonverbal conduct. Verbal assertions can imply things. We saw an example of this in the Zenny case. People called the defendant's house to place bets. when they called, they were not stating directly that the defendant was a bookie. They were just placing their bets. But their statements implied that he was a bookie. Now, whenever we look at non-assertive conduct, we have to ask, is the conduct a statement? And under the Federal Rules of Evidence and California Evidence Code, we have to ask whether the conduct was intended to convey information or to make an assertion. If the conduct was not intended as an assertion, then it is not considered a statement under the rules and is not considered hearsay. Recall here one other important requirement for implied assertion to constitute a statement. Only statements or implied conduct by persons fall within the rules. So, as we saw, the statement of an animal or the conduct of an animal, such as a bloodhound or a drug-sniffing dog, does not constitute a statement. Now let's turn to the Confrontation Clause, which is in the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. That provision guarantees a criminal defendant the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses against him. Notice, first of all, it only applies in criminal proceedings, and only to the accused, not to the government. The right is to have confrontation, which is an in-court cross-examination in the presence of a defendant. First, we saw the Crawford case in 2004. Let me caution that if you are using study materials that predate this, they may be out of date and may not include this information. In the Crawford case, Sylvia spoke with the police while in custody. Her statements were not hearsay because she implicated herself in a crime, so the statements were against her penal interest. The government offered the statements against the criminal defendant, even though Sylvia did not testify. The court held that the statements were testimonial and that there was no exception under the Confrontation Clause for unavailable witnesses, unless the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine the witness. Now, the court distinguished casual statements, which it said were not testimonial. In Crawford, the defendant did not have a prior opportunity to cross-examine Sylvia, so the evidence, which the court held was testimonial, was barred. The court also explained that certain other statements were also testimonial. This included grand jury testimony, testimony at a preliminary hearing, police interrogations, even though they are not under oath, and affidavits and depositions. The court also suggested dying declarations were not testimonial, but left this point open. We'll revisit this in a subsequent case. The court also said that other statements were not testimonial. For example, business records typically are not testimonial, and statements in furtherance of a conspiracy also are not testimonial. Neither of these types of statements were intended to be used at trial. The next major case on the Confrontation Clause is actually two cases, Davis v. Washington and Hammond v. Washington. Davis involved a 911 call. The court said the part of the call dealing with the emergency situation was not testimonial, but the rest of the call was. Hammond involved police responding to a domestic violence call, interviewing the wife, and having her sign an affidavit indicating that a battery had occurred. The court said there was no ongoing emergency and the affidavit was testimonial. The last case we read in this section on the Confrontation Clause was Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts from 2009. Here, the Supreme Court said that statements in an affidavit by a forensic analyst were testimonial and did not fall within the business record exception. The justices debated whether the criminal justice system would grind to a halt if all forensic analysts needed to go to court and testify, but the majority thought that the defense would stipulate in most cases, and also thought it was important that the analysts testify and be confronted, since analysts do make mistakes. We will see in our continuing study of hearsay that a number of other cases have addressed this question of whether particular types of statements are testimonial or not under the Confrontation Clause. That's the end of this summary.